Accession number 4697, rill number 2.
Mr. Steward, naval cameramen and photographers, reel 2. In your time in the AKS, how did you get on with the army people?
Oh, fine. I mean, marvellous, because I couldn't be allocated any guard duty because I was in naval uniform and I was a chief petty officer. And I was a petty officer then, that's right. And so wherever we went, I mean, I always had the evening free because where the others had to do guard duty, they couldn't put me on guard duty in an army establishment. So I had the best of both worlds, really.
And how did the army view your rank when you went to barracks?
Well, I used to get salutes because half the chaps in the barracks saw all this gold buttons and thought, I must be an officer. But it was my number one suit that I used to wear most of the time because the other one didn't fit very well. And it was rather embarrassing having to salute people back. And you did it to stop them from being embarrassed, really.
John Wilcox and Dennis Cook, the two men who were transferred from the FRU to the AKS.
That's right, yeah.
They remained in the army while you were, in fact, recalled HMS Excellent in June of 1943.
That's right.
Why do you think they stayed and you were, in fact, recalled?
Well, the only reason I can think of that I was a petty officer, and I suppose the Navy thought that they didn't mind losing a couple of ordinary seamen, but a petty officer was something different. So I think that was the thought, and the Navy realised at last they ought to do something about these, getting a film unit together, although it was a bit late by now. But that's the only reason I can think of.
When you were recalled to HMS Excellent, did you know for what purpose you had been recalled?
No, it was strange, because I had to go to Excellent, and you have to go to the RTO. And when I got there, my patrol service rank was engineman, and the man said to me, he said, "Oh, engineman, I expect you're for the boiler house. They've got an engine down there." And I thought, oh, blimey, I thought there was going to do better than this. And I began to wonder whether I was going to the film unit. But after a couple of days, they sort of went through my papers and eventually found myself at Tipner, where I wanted to be anyway.
Did any promotion attend this?
Yes, I got to Tipner. I was made chief petty officer. And all the other people there, the other ranks there, were just ordinary seamen. So I was the only chief petty officer at Tipner. There were, was Gordon Dines, who was a lieutenant, who, you know, and Paddy Carstairs, who was a lieutenant. But the others were all just ordinary seamen.
Who was your superior at, your direct superior officer?
I suppose Alan Izard was, really. I mean, he had the responsibility of organising the shooting of the films, although Commander Phillips was really the head executive officer, but because he knew nothing about films, and I don't think he ever learned anything about films. He'd been a gunnery officer at the time, and I think he'd been retired before the war and brought back to act as executive officer for the film unit.
How was Phillips regarded by the film unit?
Well, I think they put him a bit of a character, really, because he never seemed to learn anything about making films. I suppose you couldn't expect it, and he was probably 60 at that time. And I think he tried hard, but he wasn't a film man. So,
did Alan Izard have a film background?
I think he'd worked in the documentary business before the war. But I can't find any information about him, and I don't know what's happened to him after the war, because I've never heard his name crop up since then.
When you arrived, what were facilities like at Tipner?
Well, they got some good, very good camera equipment, a couple of Mitchells and Newman Sinclairs. And, you know, the Mitchells were brand new.
Which did you prefer to use?
Well, the Mitchell, because, I mean, it was a more professional camera. I mean, the Sinclair was good for lots of things like flying, but the viewfinder system was so far away from the lens that if you were shooting close up, you know, you never knew whether you were going to get the thing in frame or not. I mean, although you could actually move, there was a thing that you could move on the finder. You couldn't move it while you were shooting.
So the Mitchell was the one primarily used for Timlin.
But the Newman was very reliable for a clockwork camera. And if you were doing flying stuff, it was ideal because the viewfinder thing didn't come into operation then because the parallax was negligible because you were shooting stuff 800 or 200 feet away. So there was no problem there.
What were the darkroom facilities like?
Well, we didn't really have anything to do with the darkroom. I mean, all we used the darkroom for was to load the film, and we didn't do any tests or anything.
I believe there was also an animation unit.
Yes. Now, the animation unit, we didn't have a lot to do, although they were, you know, just across from where our room was. We didn't have a lot to do with them, but I saw some of the work, and I thought it was very instructive, much more instructive than the sort of stuff we were doing.
As Tipner expanded during the course of the war, accommodation must have become very difficult. What were conditions like?
Well, you see, you've got Whale Island right next door to you, and they just shoot you onto Whale Island. And well, I was all right. I was in the chief petty officer's mess, and they always looked after themselves, so it wasn't too bad.
Did many live out in the surrounding area?
Yes, most of them did, because you never knew where you were going, and it was much better for you to live out. And sometimes you would have to get your meals at awkward times when you were filming, which couldn't be catered for in the normal naval routine.
So discipline would have been quite lax, as it couldn't really encompass the film.
Yes, it wasn't. I mean, the only time you got any discipline was if you walked across the square at Excellent. You always had to run. Otherwise, you'd get somebody shouting at you.
What were relations like between the film people and the gunnery school?
Well, I think they seemed to get on all right. We really didn't have a lot of to do with the gunnery school, because that was an Excellent, and Tipner's the other side of the bridge, and they seemed to get on all right. Anything we had to shoot over there, we were very friendly.
With so many artists and film people gathered together, the society at Tipner must have been pleasant.
It was, because we all had film backgrounds. And we got on very well together.
Did you find this a great difference from your time in the patrol service?
Oh, yes. I mean, when I was on patrol with the ISIS, it was very friendly. But when I went back to Lowestoft, most of the fellows there were engineers on fishing boats. And I really felt really out of it there. I couldn't make contact at all. They would think something was wrong with me.
Did you think the film people formed a sort of exclusive set? Do you think they thought of themselves as an elite?
Well, I think slightly. They certainly felt they were exclusive, but whether they felt they were elite, I wouldn't like to say. But they're certainly exclusive, yes. You could say, I mean, they used to go round together. There was a club in Portsmouth, the Arts Club, I think it was called. And they were the main spring of that, I think. I mean, they used to do plays and had poetry readings, and one of the fellows had an uncle who was Solomon, the pianist. So we had a good selection, really.
Can you remember any of your early films at Tipner?
Yes, the ones I seem to work on were rockets, which had wires coming from them, and these rockets were fired, and eventually you got covered with wire. I don't know if these... I believe they did bring one plane down during the war, but I found them very boring to work on.
How long would a project of this sort take?
It seemed to be 2 or 3 weeks at least, because you had to go to places and get permission, and then the man that was working the rockets or wasn't coming back from leave, so you would sort of hang around and try and do something else. So, you know, it wasn't like a commercial venture.
You used a Vinton slow-motion camera.
Yes, we did.
How did you find using that?
It was disastrous every time we used it. You'd get going and all of a sudden you hear this noise and it was a jam. And when film gets jammed in the camera, it does so much damage it's almost irreparable. I mean, things get bent that can't be bent back. They are bent back, but they're never bent back with a correct precision. And so eventually we never used it. I mean, went on and on and on. Stayed away from using slow motion. Because we could use the Mitchells for a certain amount of slow motion, say up to 6 or 7 times, but the Vinton was supposed to be, you know, 10, 20 times, but terrible noise.
At Tipner, did you make mainly instructional films, or did you ever work on propaganda, feature type?
Well, mostly instructional, but we made... A feature type called Keep 'Em Flying, which was, I think it's three or four reeler at least. That was reasonably interesting because we went onto aircraft carriers and did some takeoffs and landings, which was... We had Wren sort of looking after the radios when we were doing that sort of thing. They used to be flying with us. And see these young girls taking these radios apart was incredible. She'd throw out a vowel, say, it's not that one, it's this one. And
where did you do your studio work for something like Keep 'Em Flying? Would you go to a commercial studio?
No, I think if we did any studio stuff, we would do it in one of the hangars, you see, because there's plenty of room there, and as it was about aeroplanes, that you did it in the hangar. We very seldom used the studio at Tipner, hardly ever. The rumour was that they'd built half a ship there, and it was made like a proper ship. And when it came to shooting, the director said, well, take that down. The people nearly fainted because they'd made it as if the ship was going to sea. And they had to get the saws out, and you know, could hear the grumbling in the background. Oh, what they were doing this for?
So most of your work was on location?
Yes, yes.
Did you find, in the course of your time at Tipner, that instructional films, the tempo of making instructional films became much more rapid and it became slicker? You mentioned 2 to 3 weeks for your project on the 2-inch rocket weapon.
No, it seemed to go along, as far as I can recollect, about the same pace. It wasn't till towards the end of the war when we did Keep 'Em Flying and Guns, which was another sort of feature type, which was Terry Bishop directed, and that was a much more interesting film to work on and a better type of film.
As the tempo of the war increases, projects for invasion grow apace. How closely was Tipner involved in that? Did you do any instructional films on invasion equipment?
Well, I think it was intended that Gordon Dines and I were to go over on D-Day or the day after D-Day, and we were sent up to London to attend a conference at the American headquarters in, I think it was Great Portland Street. And every foot you move, you had to show a pass. And eventually, we ended up in a room with generals, and there was nobody below a colonel in there, and we all sat around a big table, and it was all to do with the invasion, and we sat there and they were making speeches, and I thought, well, they're taking a long time getting to our filming bit, and we sat there nodding to all the different speeches and looking at the people next door, to us who were, as I say, at least colonel or brigadier. And after we'd been there an hour, the door opened and said, is Dines or Steward here? And they said, yeah, we are here, yes. And they said, well, you're in the wrong meeting. And as we left, the man in charge, he said, we won't say anything about this, will you? I thought, well, this is jolly good secrecy for wartime. We're sitting in the wrong meeting with all these passes having to be shown before we could even enter the building.
And were Dines and yourself sent to Normandy?
Well, no. I think Dines went, but I wasn't. I don't know what happened, but I wasn't sent. But Gordon Dines went over there and stayed for a couple of days and came back.
Do you know what the purpose of this film project to Normandy was?
Just to show that, I think, as the Army covered it so well, the Navy thought, well, we ought to cover our end of it, but whether that was the reason, I don't know.
What do you think was the general Royal Naval attitude to cameramen embarked on Her Majesty's ships?
Oh, they were very helpful. And they would do anything, almost turn an aircraft carrier around if you wanted to and it was safe so to do. And never had any problem, not like today. You'd have a lot of problems today to getting an aircraft carrier to turn around, but they were very good indeed, I must say.
Did you ever find the requirements of secrecy and confidentiality ever restricted your filming programs?
No, they were the stuff that I worked on wasn't all that secret, but Martin Curtis worked on the submersible canoes, and I didn't know until after the war what he was working on. I knew they were going away and they were working in swimming baths, but it wasn't until after the war was over that I found out what they were shooting. And, you know, considering we were all together, it was very good as far as the secrecy end was concerned.
Did the exigencies of the service ever interfere with filming? Obviously, warships could be called away at any moment. Did you ever find this happening in the middle of a
production? Yes, to a certain extent, we were to our advantage because we were working down in Plymouth on a Star Shells film, and we had a very keen young director who'd just come into the Naval Film Unit, and he thought it would be a good idea if we went out with a destroyer that was going out and filmed some of their star shells. And he dashed over to this destroyer and spoke to the captain, and the captain must have given him the okay, and he was shouting to us, and we didn't hear him. I don't particularly think we wanted to hear him, but the destroyer left with him on board, and they went out shooting at E-boats all night, and the sea was rough, and he had a terrible time. When he came back, he looked terrible, and he never wanted to go out and destroy her again. We didn't particularly want to go out anyway. But
presumably, the cameras would hardly have been able to take film under star shell conditions.
No, I mean, although it looked light, I mean, the speed of the film was about 80 ASA, which isn't very much. Even today, I mean, the colour film is more than that.
Doesn't this suggest a rather remarkable degree of ignorance of filmic conditions?
Well, you see, at night, when you're out at night and they film, they used to put these star shells up, they look terribly bright because anything around would be silhouetted, but photographically it was nothing. It was just lighting a match, really. I mean, a match in the dark looks bright, but
Do you often find, as a skilled cameraman, that you are having to advise people who are nominally your superiors that have been drafted by the Navy to make film production?
Yes, and in a case like that, but not all that very often, because, I mean, that's an exceptional case.
You remain at Tipner making these instructional films. As the war progresses, presumably large numbers of American productions arrive.
Yes.
How do you think they compared with the British ones?
Oh, they were much better. I found them, the voices and the way they were put over were much more interesting. I always found that our voices over were done by actors who were reading from a script and had no feeling for whatever they were doing, probably never seen the thing that they were talking about, but just reading it off in a very dull voice that would put you to sleep in no time. Whereas the Americans, they involved some of the best actors and must have got, and who were probably in the American naval film unit anyway, so they were keen to put it over as best they could.
Did you ever cooperate with American film teams?
No, we were once on an American ship for filming something. I can't remember what it was, and we found the food on the ship was absolutely out of this world. After our dreary diet on most of the English ships, I mean, everybody, the steak and the pies. This was down at Portland Bill. We, for some reason, we were on this American ship. And I always remember the good food. That's one thing I can always remember about it.
Did the Navy ever use you for other purposes? Were you ever contracted out in your role as a cameraman?
Yes, towards the end of the war, there was a Canadian Navy show which was on in London and very successful. Somebody decided to make a film about it, and they went to the studios at Elstree and shot the show, but they also wanted some Canadian background shots, and I don't know why, but we at Tipner, they rang up Tipner and asked if we've got anybody to spare. There must have been a lack of spare staff in the industry itself, and I was sent out to Canada on an aircraft carrier and flew across to Vancouver, and we did a lot of shooting on the way and out in Vancouver, and had a very good time, actually. That was the only time I'd ever shot anything except for the naval film itself.
Towards the end of the war, there was a project under Anthony Kimmins to send stills, men, and cameraman out to the Far East. Were you at all involved in
this? Yes, the whole of Tipner, practically, except for myself and a few others, volunteered. I'd been in the Navy about five years, and I didn't particularly want to go anywhere except to Civvy Street. And they all went, and the idea was to film the invasion of Japan. And, of course, because of the atom bomb, they all had a nice 6 months holiday in Australia.
And so you just remained at Tipner until you were demobbed in January of 1946?
Yes, in fact, when I came back from Vancouver, as I got off the plane, somebody said, here are your demob papers. They certainly organised that pretty quickly, much quicker than anything else that happened during the time I was in the Navy.
What generally did you think of the Royal Naval attitude to it?
Well, I think the Navy never really got seriously into making films during the war, not like the Army and the Air Force. And it was a pity because there's so much to show in the Navy, travelling all over the world. But they weren't film-minded. I don't think they probably are today.